Karim Nazir was born to itinerant Pakistani parents. He grew up in New York, where he went to a special school. All the children there were, like him, autistic. Karim Nazir now lives in London. He's a policy advisor for the British Civil Service, and his writing has appeared in British newspapers and magazines. But it was his school in New York that prompted Karim Nazir's first book. He wondered what had happened to his long-ago classmates. So he tracked them down, and you can find the results under the title Send in the Idiots, Stories from the Other Side of Autism. When Anne Strangechamps talked with Karim Nazir, she wondered where the title of his book came from.
One of our teachers liked to read the newspaper, and she wasn't able to do it before she got to class, and so she read the newspaper during the break, except we wouldn't let her. We were very curious about what she was doing, and we wanted to know what was in it. So we would force her to read the newspaper aloud. And of course we'd be doing other little activities at the same time, because autistic children often manifest a very strong desire for local coherence, and they manifest that by playing with things or by rocking or by doing some other kind of repetitive motion. And during this time, Craig, he certainly used to demonstrate echolalia, which is where a child picks up a word or a phrase and uses it again and again. And for a time, Craig's phrase was send in the idiots. And so I like to imagine this juxtaposition of our teacher reading from the newspaper and Craig from time to time shouting out send in the idiots.
Well, this particular group of kids, they were remarkable kids, and many of you grown up to be remarkable people. I mean, today you work for the British government as a policy advisor in Whitehall. You've written this book. That's an extraordinary outcome, isn't it?
I hope so. I do feel good about what I've been able to do.
Do you think of yourself as still autistic?
Now, it's something I've really tussled with over the writing of this book. I think it really came to a head when I met up with the woman who used to be the director of our school. I sat across the table from her at a coffee shop, and she didn't say anything. We'd corresponded by email beforehand, so I knew a little bit about what she was doing now and what was happening in her life, and she knew about my project and about the other people that I'd managed to find. She said hello, and then she stopped talking. So I started talking, and she was just giving me no response. And this began to puzzle me very much, but I continued to make an effort to have a conversation. And then eventually I did confront her, I mean, a few minutes later. And as soon as I confronted her, she looked straight back at me and she said, "You're not autistic." And she was testing me, essentially, as she admitted. Then we laughed about it. She basically wanted to see what would happen if she put me under strain like that in the conversation. She wanted to see how I would deal with that situation. And her feeling was that, sure, there may be small ways in which my autism still manifests itself, but it's not a fundamental problem for me. It doesn't affect me in what I think are some of the quite profound ways in which it still does affect my classmates. I mean, for example, there's a coil of wire in front of me, and I'm sort of playing with that a little bit. Frequently at work, I have a clip in my hand, especially during meetings, a bulldog clip or a crocodile clip. I sort of open and close it and put my finger in between and that sort of thing.
Do you do that when you're feeling stressed, and is it calming?
It's calming, yeah. It also just helps me to focus. It means, for example, that I'm not focusing on irrelevant things. Like, for example, I'm not focusing on how many people in the room are wearing something that's green. I'm not, you know, focusing on whether there's a stain on the window.
Mm-hmm. There's a phrase you use to describe some of those kinds of behaviors. It's the effort to establish local coherence.
That's right. What often happens for autistic people is that they actually feel overwhelmed by the sense data that they're taking in. Autistic people often notice lots and lots of detail. They often notice detail that other people simply wouldn't notice. They also often experience what's called synesthesia, which is that they link particular sounds or particular textures with certain colors. So if you can imagine, especially as an autistic child, you don't have language, and so you're not able to explain these sensations to anyone. But at the same time, whenever you hear a very, very loud sound, not only are you hearing a very loud sound, but your brain is lighting up with a color, and that's just very, very confusing. And it continues to be the case for autistic adults that they experience things in those ways. And so what they do to try and counteract that is they focus on something very small, something very meaningless, like playing with a clip, playing with a pen, like rubbing their fingers on a table, sensations or activities that are familiar to them. And through doing those activities, they're able to avoid being flooded by all the sense data that they're taking in.
Mm-hmm. What did you expect from your classmates when you started to look them up? Did you assume that they'd perhaps all be doing as well as you were?
I wasn't really sure of what to expect. I think that what I expected actually was for them not to have changed that much. And I felt that way because I'd started reading a lot about autism before I started going to see them. And a lot of what's written about autism implies that the difficulties that autistic people have are in some sense permanent. A lot of that material implies that autism is essentially an emotional disorder or a psychological disorder, and that all that autistic people are ever able to do is to cope. All that they're ever able to do is to fake certain activities. They're only ever able to fake social interaction. They're never able to do it properly. You know, they don't get it quite right. And I think because I'd been reading all that stuff, when I went to meet people, I think I kind of expected them to conform to what I'd been reading. And instead, what I found was something very different. Instead, I found that they had all changed massively and that they could identify that change in themselves. Another thing that I was really struck by was that I think when I went to see them, I expected to see each of them just individually. So in that way, kind of my own conception of their lives and my own conception of this book was an autistic one. I thought that I would be interviewing them, you know, their selves alone. But it turned out, for example, the first person that I went to see is Andre, and Andre lives with his sister. And so not only was I interacting with Andre, I was interacting with his sister. And of course, that's exactly right, because his sister is a really fundamental presence in his life. They live together. They see each other every single day. And so if I was writing about Andre's life, then I also had to write about Amanda. And that, I think, was also unexpected for me. It shouldn't have been, but it was.
Well, tell me about some of the kids you went back and rediscovered. Your friend Andre, for example, he's doing very well working with computers, right?
That's right. He has a good job. He's doing exactly what he wants. He wanted to be a computer researcher, and that's what he's getting to do. I mean, Andre still does have some quite severe difficulties. For Andre in particular, the difficulty is that he finds communication and social interaction still very difficult. And whenever he's doing it, and whenever he feels under stress, when he's perhaps having to deal with disagreement, or when he's having to talk about something that upsets him, or when he's in a setting where he's having to interact with several people, his first line of defense is those small repetitive actions that we were talking about earlier. When those activities don't work, and for him often they don't work, Andre's devised quite an ingenious second line of defense. And his second line of defense is that he uses puppets. And these are puppets that he makes himself. Now, he doesn't ventriloquize, but what he does is that he takes the puppet out and he puts it down on a table or a surface, or if there isn't one, then he just holds it in his hand. And then he talks.
He doesn't talk in the puppet's voice? He doesn't give it a different voice?
From time to time he does when he's being playful, but for the most part, he simply talks in his own voice, but he has the puppet out. I think what he's doing is that he's, in a way, embodying a really crucial idea about conversation, which is that conversation, I think, is in some sense, it's not quite authentic. Conversation is in some sense insincere. I don't mean that we tell lies to each other, and I don't mean it harshly at all. I think what I mean is that, for example, sometimes we laugh at someone's joke, not because it's funny, but because we want to put them at ease. Sometimes we say things that we don't necessarily believe, but we say them in order to move the conversation along. Sometimes we take a particular role in a conversation, and that role may not actually be how we're feeling or how we're thinking, but it's the role that we take. And I think through using these puppets, what Andre is allowing himself to do is to play along with all those facets of conversation. And he doesn't feel able to do it when it's just him. But somehow when he has the puppet out, he feels that he is able to do those things because suddenly it's the puppet that's interacting with other people and not him. And so he's allowed to be insincere. He's allowed to say things that make him feel a bit uncomfortable because he has that little bit of distance from it.
That's fascinating. It's sort of making explicit the notion that, in fact, we really are multiple selves. You know, even though we have this myth we've created that we are a single self, in fact, and through conversation, we're always kind of working out, playing with, experimenting with our multiple selves.
I think so. And what's very exciting to me is that even Andre, who finds this process very difficult, that he actually wants to do it, and that he wants to do it so much that he's gone to this trouble of making puppets, and that he exposes himself to ridicule, and that he exposes himself potentially to people thinking he's really a very odd person, but that he does it all because he actually wants to be involved in that process.
You met a lot of former classmates who, like you, have been successful and who got better. Not everybody did. I'm thinking in particular about a former classmate named Elizabeth.
Yes. What happened to Elizabeth is very sad. I'm always hesitant to say that it was entirely because of her autism. Elizabeth killed herself a few years ago. She first, of course, had her quite severe difficulties with autism. She then developed epilepsy, and she also developed manic depression. And I think it's just the strain of doing simple things was so much, and that there were multiple strains. It wasn't just the difficulties introduced by her autism. There were all these other things that she had to cope with as well.
And it was just too much?
It's hard to say, isn't it? My guess would be something like that. It's something that her parents were very reluctant to get drawn into speculating about. Her parents are very interesting people, and her parents actually, I think, are two of the nicest people that I've ever met. They're remarkably good at not feeling guilty about what happened to their daughter, and they're remarkably good about wanting to give her credit for the things that she did achieve. For example, she taught herself how to ride a bike, and she taught herself how to ride a bike. It wasn't that her parents taught her how to do it or a neighbor taught her how to do it. She did it herself. She observed someone else riding a bike, and she observed very closely, and she started doing it herself. And what I also like about the episode of her learning to ride her bike is her parents' response to it. Her mother came home unexpectedly from work early one day, and she saw Elizabeth riding the bike on the street. And she was, of course, shocked, very, very surprised that her daughter was doing this and that her daughter was capable of doing it. But rather than sort of running down the driveway and throwing her arms around her, she pretended that she hadn't seen it, which might seem like a very odd response, but I think it was a wonderful response. She wanted Elizabeth to have that achievement for herself, and she wanted to know about it when Elizabeth chose to tell them about it. She didn't want to take that moment of revelation away from Elizabeth. She didn't want to take that moment of Elizabeth saying, "Look what I can do," away from her. And in fact, that's how it worked in the end. They waited until Elizabeth told them the story of how she'd learned how to ride a bike.
Kamram Nazir is the author of Send in the Idiots, Stories from the Other Side of Autism. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps.